And you're listening to Classical Radio, KSUI in Iowa City. It's 6 o'clock, and Peter, are you ready?
Ready is as ready does. Just a second, here's the theme. Hello there, I'm Peter Schickele, and this is Schickele Mix, a program dedicated to the proposition that all musics are created equal. Or as Duke Ellington put it, if it sounds good, it is good. Now, I don't know much about program funding, but I know what I like. And I very much like the fact that our bills are paid by this very radio station right here, in this very town. There are two composers that almost all musicians absolutely idolize, Bach and Mozart. It's interesting. Everybody knows what a heavyweight Beethoven was, but he's like an amazing human, whereas Bach and Mozart feel like they're just a bit above the human plane. Anyway, in spite of the tremendous variety of composers who have expressed their great awe of Mozart, Chopin, Wagner, Elliot Carter, many more, there is something that is unique about Bach, and that is that almost no matter what you do to him, he shines through. You can swing him, you can rock him, you can romanticize him, you can play him on just about any bunch of instruments you can think of, and it always seems to work. I don't know of any other composer whose work has been used, in one way or another, by so many other composers and arrangers. We've got a great variety of pieces based on the old man's music coming up here, which is why today's program is called The Bach of Gibraltar. Little play on words there. But Bach has been the bottom line of Western musical culture in more ways than one. He is the earliest composer who can be called a staple of our concert halls. His tonal language has for many, many years been the starting point in the teaching of harmonic analysis. And he had more children than any other famous composer. We're going to start out by making a distinction between, or should I say among, three different terms: transcription, arrangement, and based upon. Transcription is the simplest, in the sense of involving the least change. You simply adapt the music as faithfully as possible to different instruments and/or voices. You don't add anything, and you don't leave anything out unless you're forced to. I was once hired to do an arrangement of Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring for an album that the conductor Leopold Stokowski made late in his life. The original is basically for chorus and strings. There's a harpsichord in there and some winds doubling the strings, but the constant on the Stokowski album was string orchestra and harpsichord. I wanted to be as faithful as possible to the original. I couldn't give the choral lines to string instruments because they wouldn't stand out the way a chorus does. They would sound too much like the other string parts. And I couldn't give the choral lines to brass instruments because Bach never used brass instruments that way at all. It wouldn't sound of the period. So I gave the parts to four double reeds. I simply wrote out the soprano part for oboe, the alto part for a second oboe, the tenor part for English horn, and the bass part for bassoon. That's all I did. Years later, somebody told me they thought that my arrangement on that album was the best arrangement they'd ever heard. Now, I love compliments, but I felt a little embarrassed because I didn't think that I'd really done enough to deserve such fulsome praise. I suppose I can take some credit for leaving well enough alone and choosing four instruments that fit Bach's complexion, but to let myself get a swelled head over that compliment would be like finding a particularly beautiful stone on the beach and framing it and selling it as a work of art. Here, why don't I just play a little bit of that cut so you can hear what I'm talking about?
Thank you.
Ooh, hurts to turn it down. Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring by our man Bach, played by Leopold Stokowski and his orchestra, which means New York freelancers. And although I was paid and credited as an arranger on that cut, I would, strictly speaking, call it a transcription. It's hard to imagine changing less than I did in that chart. Our next item, however, I would call a real arrangement. It's still basically Bach, but a lot more choices have been made, and there's been some stuff added. Before we hear it, we'll hear the original piece of which it's an arrangement, the second fugue from the Well-Tempered Clavier. The second fugue from the Well-Tempered Clavier, played on the harpsichord by Davitt Moroney, followed by the Swinglesingers version from, I believe, their first album, Bach's Greatest Hits. You know, that was a brilliant title in 1963. Now it's become a complete cliché to use greatest hits with classical composers. I don't think there's any composer they haven't put out a greatest hits album of. Although, I don't think I've run across greatest hits of Gregorian chant. Anyway, those Swinglesingers things stay remarkably and charmingly close to the original pieces, but the arranger still had a lot of decisions to make. How to divide up the parts, since most instruments have wider ranges than most singers. What syllables to sing, since the original was instrumental. Whether to change the key of the piece to fit the singers. And, of course, in this case, to add drums and a newly composed line for the string bass. Okay, we've had a transcription and an arrangement. Now let's hear a song that is based on Bach. The differences here are enormous. To start with, the meter, the organization of the beats, is changed. The original Bach is in 3/4 time, whereas the song is in 4/4 time. Words have been added to an originally instrumental line, and the accompaniment is completely different. And Bach's whole melody is not followed, just the first, simplest, supposedly most memorable part. You know, actually, Bach may not have written the original melody. Then again, maybe he did. It's from a collection of pieces, some original and some by unidentified contemporaries, put together for his wife's use in practicing harpsichord, the Little Notebook for Anna Magdalena Bach. Whether or not it's by Bach, we know for sure that it's a minuet. Hey, Johann Sebastian, how do you like them apples? Gustav Leonhardt played the minuet from the Little Notebook for Anna Magdalena Bach, and the Toys sang a Lover's Concerto. Now, I'm not sure that a Lover's Concerto belongs up there in the great pantheon of song. Now, don't get me wrong, I think it deserves to be heard. But I'm not sure it's really up there with the songs of Schubert, Brahms, and Debussy. Our next song, however, is... It's based on a chorale melody that Bach used many times. Here again, Bach didn't actually write the melody. It's one of the hundreds of hymns written by Luther and others after the Reformation. But most of us know it only through Bach's numerous settings. No two alike, but all beautiful. So we think of it as Bach. There are 5 settings of this tune in the St. Matthew Passion alone, of which we'll hear the second, followed by a beautiful song based on the same melody.
Many's the time I've been mistaken, and many times confused. Yes, and I've often felt forsaken, and certainly misused. Oh, but I'm all right, I'm all right, just weary to my bones. Still, you don't expect to be bright and bon vivant so far away from home. So far away from home. I don't know a soul who's not been battered. I don't have a friend who feels at ease. I don't know a dream that's not been shattered or driven to its knees. Oh, but it's all right, it's all right, for we lived so well so long. Still, when I think of the road we're traveling on, I wonder what's gone wrong. I can't help it, I wonder what's gone wrong. And I dreamed I was dying. I dreamed that my soul rose unexpectedly. Looking back down at me, smiled reassuringly. And I dreamed I was flying, and high up above, my eyes could clearly see the Statue of Liberty sailing away to sea. And I dreamed I was flying. For we come on the ship they call the Mayflower. We come on the ship that sails the moon. We come in the ages most uncertain hours and sing an American tune. Oh, and it's alright, it's alright, it's alright. You can't be forever. Tomorrow's gonna be another working day, and I'm trying to get some rest. That's all I'm trying, to get some rest.
The chorale Ich Will Hier Bei Dir Stehen from the St. Matthew Passion, with John Elliott Gardiner conducting the English Baroque soloists in the Monteverdi Choir, followed by An American Tune by Paul Simon. You know, I've always loved that song, and I must say I'm a little embarrassed that I never made the connection to the Bach chorale until I saw Jimmy Carter's inaugural concert on TV, and Simon, in introducing the song, mentioned that he wrote it with a little help from Bach. He goes beyond the chorale melody himself, but the debt to the Bach is obvious and moving. I'm Peter Schickele. The show is Schickele Mix from PRI, Public Radio International. And it's tidbit time on the old stream. You get it? Stream. Bach. Bach means stream in German. I don't know what it is. I'm just hooked on wordplay today. Well, there are worse things to be hooked on. At any rate, our tidbit is entitled Potato Song / Bach Prelude, and it's off an album by Dan Arthurs. I think it's safe to say that this is one of the most unusual cuts I've ever run across, or has ever run across me.
blossoms to bloom. I'm in love with you. You know how I feel when we're frolicking through the potato field. There'll be enough potatoes for the little ones to make big, strong potato men. The harvest is here, the potato dance will start. All the boys and girls dancing heart to heart.
Okay. Dan Arthur's Don't Say I Didn't Warn You, Potato Song, followed by a rendition of the prelude from the first unaccompanied cello suite by Bach. Before we go on, I'd like to talk a little bit about Bach's place in history. The standard picture is that Bach was forgotten as a composer soon after he died, if not even before, and that it wasn't until almost 80 years later, when Mendelssohn conducted a performance of the St. Matthew Passion, that his music became known again, and since then, interest in it has continued unabated to the present day. And that's true. although there were certain cognoscenti during that interim period, Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven among them, who knew some of Bach's music and were greatly influenced by it. But the implication of that picture is that here was this great composer who was unfairly ignored by posterity until Mendelssohn came along and restored him to his rightful place in music lovers' affections. Well, the trouble with that is that until the 19th century, that's the way it was for everybody. It's not much of an exaggeration to say that until Beethoven's time, nobody listened to the music of dead composers. People wanted the latest stuff. They wanted something new. Any classical musician today who isn't intimately familiar with the music of Bach will not be considered educated. But do you think Bach was intimately familiar with the music of Josquin des Prez, who lived 250 years before Bach? No way, José des Prez. It was in the 19th century that people got obsessed with the past. Okay, it started rolling in the 18th century in some fields, although not in music. But the 19th century saw the flowering of the worship of the past, digging up Egyptian tombs, studying fossils, reveling in ruins, passing off new poetry as old, and performing the works of dead composers. Also, the perfection of mass printing techniques made more material available to more people, and the concept of complete editions became popular. Music was published immediately, sometimes even before it was performed, and then it had to be printed again after the composer made corrections. Music engraving, you know, was the license plates of the 19th century, right? If you said right, you're either extremely quick and knowledgeable, or you're one of those people who says right even though they didn't understand what was said. The thing is, a lot of the music engraving in the 19th century was done by inmates in prisons. You know, just like in this century, they made a license plate. Okay, well, anyway, Bach wasn't given a raw deal. He was given the normal deal of his day. But listen, I'm glad he's still with us now. And now is when we're going to experience the Haven't I Heard You Somewhere Before suite, featuring one of the most famous pieces in the history of Western music. We'll hear it first as Bach wrote it, then as the accompaniment for a song, then as a framework for an improvisation, and finally, as the basis for a parody of minimalist music. The Haven't I Heard You Somewhere Before suite lasts about 13 and a half minutes, after which, like Bach and General MacArthur, I shall return.
topsy-topsy.
Kind of gets you in the gut, doesn't it? The Haven't I Heard You Before Somewhere Sweet started off with the first prelude from the Well-Tempered Clavier, played on the harpsichord by David Moroney. Then we had Kathleen Battle and Christopher Parkening on the guitar. She's singing the famous Ave Maria, written by Gounod, over the prelude by Bach, using the prelude as an accompaniment. Then we have a nice album called Unsquare Dance by Bill Crowfoot with Chris Brubeck and Joel Brown. And they do an improvisation based on the prelude. Some of you, by the way, who maybe know the prelude very well might have noticed that some of the chords are a little bit different. And apparently, according to the liner notes here, they have based it on a version of this prelude that appears in the Little Notebook for Wilhelm Friedemann Bach, another little didactic book that Bach put together. And apparently he had a different version of it going at one time and then changed it for the Well-Tempered Clavier. And then finally, we closed off with PDQ Bach's epic and classic prelude to the opera Einstein on the Fritz, Schickele number E equals MT squared. And this, of course, is remarkably prescient of the minimalist music of this century. A little story about that. Philip Glass, one of the prime minimalists, is an old friend of mine. We went to Juilliard together, and I called him up in September, several years ago, before premiering this piece, and I talked to his lady friend, and I said, I'm going to do a takeoff on Philip at Christmas concerts this year in New York, and I hope you two can come. And she said, well, he's in San Francisco, and he can call you tomorrow at 7. I said, great. 7 o'clock the next night, the phone rings, I pick it up, and it's Philip saying, et tu, Brute? But he liked it. He came back and had it signed. As a matter of fact, while the piece was being copied, he and I used the same copyist there for a while. He came along and she said, I'm working on the takeoff on you. And he took a look at the parts and he said, well, looks right. I'm Peter Schickele. The program is Schickele Mix from PRI, Public Radio International. We're going to end up with a song that isn't based on Bach. Why? Because a lot of folks, and I must say that included myself until I researched this show, think that it is based on Bach. It has a bass line that sounds very much like that of the famous so-called air for the G-string, and the melody line above it sounds very Bach-y, and lots of people have told me it's based on Bach. But after looking through lots of the old guy's music and consulting with the highly knowledgeable Michael Barone, whose organ program is on a lot of public radio stations, and reading in a book called Rockin' the Classics and Classicizing the Rock by Janelle R. Duxbury that the band that does the song doesn't say it's based on Bach, I've come to the conclusion that it's not based on Bach. We'll hear a little of the air from Bach's Third Orchestral Suite first, and then some Bach that isn't Bach, but it's good Bach.
The way
Procol Harum, A Whiter Shade of Pale, the entry in Rockin' the Classics and Classicizing the Rock, says Source, J.S. Bach, Suite Number 3 in D Major for Orchestra, which we heard a little of, Wacht auf, a cantata, Sleepers Awake. Then it says, this famous song is often attributed to either of the Bach pieces above. However, the band itself lays claim to neither. The tune is closest to the first, but contains some elements of both. I listened to Wacht auf again. It doesn't seem to me to contain many elements of that, but it's a great song, and the album says on the back, to be listened to in the spirit in which it was made. That's good advice for listening to any album. Eugene Normandy and the Philadelphia Orchestra were performing that excerpt from The Air that we heard first. And I guess that about wraps it up for this week. We'll... This phone is not supposed to be... Hello? Yeah, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a beautiful... Yeah, Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring by Bach. Yeah. Now, oh, yeah, and you're right. Yes, Stokowski does it beautifully. Oh, thank you. I guess the arrangement does help. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Well, yeah, I think we could probably play that, and we'll do it instead of the theme that we usually do. We'll put it on at the end and play it all the way through. Okay? Thanks for calling. Well, that's Chicoly Mix for this week. Our program is made possible with funds provided by this radio station. I just want to get through this fast so we can play the whole thing, you know. We'll tell you in a moment how you can get an official playlist of all the music on today's program, with record numbers and everything. Just refer to the program number. This is program number 34. And I'm going to get this ready here. This is Peter Chicoly saying goodbye and reminding you that it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that certain je ne sais quoi. You're looking good. See you next week. you'd like a copy of that playlist I mentioned, send a stamped self-addressed envelope to Schickele Mix. That's S-C-H-I-C-K-E-L-E, Schickele Mix. Care of Public Radio International, 100 North 6th Street, Suite 900A, Minneapolis, Minnesota, 55403.
PRI, Public Radio International.